This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. The restoration of District Hill Cemetery in Chickamauga, Georgia has been a long time in coming, but the completion of that work is in sight. District Hill is a historic African-American cemetery dedicated in 1912 and used through the 1940s until maintenance of the site stopped over time. Joyce Hazelrigg Harrison is a fourth-generation landowner of the property. Her father began the project, and she has received help from many corners along the way, including from Dr. Alicia Jackson and her students at Covenant College. As part of a course on African-American history, Alicia's students have researched and written biographies on the people buried at District Hill. Alicia, Joyce, thanks for joining us.
Thank you
for being here.
Tell us more about District Hill Cemetery.
District Hill Cemetery, if you go all the way back to the late 1800s, Gordon Lee, who was a plantation owner, had 5,000 acres in Chickamauga, Georgia. And in the late 1900s or the very late 1800s, the Lee family gave, and I put this in quotation marks, the colored people of the community a one-acre lot for a cemetery. And according to our legal papers, when his sons came and verbally gave that to the colored people who were leaders in the community, it's not a deed when you, in that day, give your word and say that. It's legally a cemetery when you put the first body in the ground. And so the first body that we have record of when it was a formal cemetery was about 1910. So it became a public cemetery, and it's 1 acre contiguous to the Hazelrigg property, which has been a problem because a lot of people think it's a private cemetery because three sides belongs to one family. But it is a public cemetery, and it existed and was established in the late 1800s when Gordon Lee's father was still alive. And it was verbally done. And then it closed in 1946.
And then just abandoned.
Well, abandoned because you're not burying anybody there. There are no formal ceremonies, rituals of any kind. People did come back on Memorial Day, which was typically something Southerners did, to clean the cemetery up. But over a period of time, because people died, they don't pass sometimes things on. The cemetery just became in disarray, part abandoned, neglect. No support for various reasons. And so my father, Willie A. Hazelrigg, has always tried to care for it and the family and some community people. But of course, with overgrowth and all, it becomes a problem. And then vandalism, people steal tombstones. And some people come in and just knock them over and destroy them. So a lot of that, which is something you really can't always prove, but what we're left with is a beautiful spot with over 130 people that were formerly put into that cemetery.
And then how is the cemetery cared for now? And you have a goal within the next 12 to 18 months.
Oh, yes. Well, cemetery for the last 10 years, at least, has been cut down from the overgrowth. We're maintaining it with every 2 weeks it's mowed. We have cleared it of trees. We have fenced it in. We have had a road improvement to get to the site. And now we have all of the grave markers that will be placed on each grave because we do not know who's in the grave, but we know the names of the people that are buried there. So we're ready now to put the grave markers on over 122 graves. About 10 of them already still have their markers on them. So approximately that.
And Alicia, that brings us to you and your students at Covenant College.
I met Ms. Harrison, in 2016 we met,
yes,
through a mutual friend, and heard about the project. I've always been really interested in doing community research and projects. And so this was a great opportunity, I thought, for our students to give back to the community and also to learn about African-American history, because it was students in my African-American history course. And so anyway, the first time I met with Mrs. Harrison in 2016, and then in 2018 is the first year I actually, well, we had some students out who began doing research on the folks who were interred there, the individuals. And so it was really powerful because the Harrisons have been so gracious to sort of give us an overview of the cemetery. We actually walk the grounds. And for many of our students, a number of them from the South, but a large majority of them are not. I mean, a number of these students are not students of color. So this is a really sort of first sort of foray into understanding African-American history. So we go there, we walk the grounds, we see some of the markers there, and then following in 2018, we began researching the people buried there. And so students, they go through, I assign them a name, and then they are tapped with going through census records, newspapers, vital records, death records, what information they can find on these individuals. And then from there, they write a paper with what biographical information they can find. And then they do research on sort of North Georgia area. And then in that, sort of take that context and then move into talking about nationally what's going on within the African-American community. So it's really been a great experience for the students. I mean, they've had tremendous buy-in and really excitement about the work they're doing. And we did that in 2018. And then in 2020, I had students in that particular class work on that project.
And you are teaching this every other year, so this is ongoing.
Yes, it is. And as a matter of fact, in 2019, I had a student, Avery Drury, who she heard about the project. She had taken one of my other courses, heard about the project. So she did a summer internship where she went and did further research, created an Excel spreadsheet where she looked at all the people buried there, the names that she had to make sure to verify if they were buried in the cemetery or elsewhere, and did some other work that we've been able to work off of in assigning additional names. So I had a student who did that. She did that. And then last summer, even though she graduated, she and another student who took my course in 2020, they spent the summer working on some of the biographies, editing them, doing, you know, sort of going back through them. And then this summer I have two students, one of the ones who worked last summer, her name is Julie Merritt, and another student this summer who are going through, going to provide the Harrisons for the project death dates and birth dates. So we're doing that this summer as well. So it's an ongoing project. It's been really exciting because of some of the things that we have found. So we have been able to identify through the kind of, and just give you a sense of what this does. One of the markers that's there that I don't know that's necessarily on the list, but her name is Lena Johnson. One of the interns this summer, Julie Merritt, discovered is that Lena's father was a teamster who worked on the fort in Fort Oglethorpe. And there are very few, if any, African-Americans who worked as teamsters. And this is 1910 that he's doing this. It was predominantly white, but he's a teamster who's working there. And he and his wife had this daughter. She only lived a few months anyway, and she died, but she's buried there. And so I know that one of the things that the Harrisons have done through this work is they've had ground penetrating radar. So they know sort of, like, for example, where there may be like infant graves. So now they have a sense with the kind of work we're doing, we can find out, we can identify that this is possibly this infant and there's another infant that we have identified on the list, that these are infant graves and could possibly be this particular child or this particular child. So not only is it giving sort of recognition of these individuals buried there, but it also tells a broader story about the Black community in North Georgia.
Even if you know where the bodies are buried, you still have to figure out, like putting together a puzzle, whose bodies are there.
If you can do that. But at least we would be able to say that these infant graves are possibly this child or that child.
Because there are four, total of four infant graves. The work that Dr. Jackson's intern did is such a masterful job because she was able to take the names that we had, and you're probably asking the question, where did they get the names? Willie A. Hazelrigg, who was my father, during his lifetime, he was born in 1921, so the graveyard, the cemetery, was very active in terms of rituals and official burials. So he knew a lot of the families there. So in 1993, he decided to write everybody on a piece of paper who he knew was buried there. He had the opportunity to talk to his mother, all of the people, and he had this all in his head, but he put it on paper. And that is how we know the names. And there are a few little discrepancies, but all in all, we have most of the names, I think. We're missing not too many names.
Right, and we haven't had a chance to talk in a while because we've been relatively pretty busy this summer. But one of the, I know at least two or three more names I've been able to identify.
Oh, that's wonderful.
That we're not on that list.
That's wonderful.
We're going through records.
I think it's unlike any other cemetery that we are discovering around the country. They discover an abandoned cemetery. There are some tombstones. A lot of times it's overgrown and not cared for. But do you know what those people did? And I think this project is unlike most projects because the people buried there had a stake in the community. They invested in the community. And that is the recognition that they need and history needs, the community needs. And so that's why I think this is a different project than just putting tombstones and keep it at nice and knowing who's there. But their lives are so important.
Another name there is Mark Thrash. Tell us more about him.
Well, there is a book about him that someone wrote. I can't give you the author, but my family knew him. He lived to be 122 years old, shy of 123 years, I think by 8 days. He was born on Christmas Day. According to history, he was born in 1952, so he was enslaved, and he was also an employee of the battlefield way before it became a formal battlefield, but he buried Union and Confederate soldiers, and he was recognized for that as well as a pensioner from the battlefield. He had a home on the battlefield. He had a job there, and he retired there with a pension. And then he lived his life out in Chickamauga and died at that wonderful age of 122. So his legacy of being someone that, according to the history, that has this not alliance or that is aligned with the Southern Union and Confederate, he was one that buried both. So he had quite a history. And people look in the battlefield, they always wanted to know about Mark Thrash and where he's buried. So he is buried there. And my father knew exactly the spot that he was buried. And they had a rededication about, I think, in the 70s or the late early 80s, where the battlefield recognized that and rededicated.
And where can people keep up online with the work there at the cemetery as more is uncovered?
Google District Hill Cemetery. But I can't stop saying that this is a major piece to where we are today. University of Georgia, the Carl Vinson Institute, took on this project, and they were funded by a foundation to look at the cemetery and develop a master plan of how we could restore it. So we are using this plan. And this, of course, has given us credence, has given us much more of a platform. An organized way to look at how to do this. So this has been good for donors to be able to see a really masterful plan for the cemetery.
I would love the opportunity to maybe eventually have something where, in terms of Covenant, where we would have, or the students in work, where we would have something digitally involved where you could actually look at some of the biographies of the folks, the individuals who were interred there. Mm-hmm. So that's something that a long-term goal that we would love to be able to do. Because I think it would be, people would be able to see the stories of the individuals who are buried there. And so one of the things that eventually I'd like to do is, there are not records for everyone, like a huge amount of records. So at least have a sampling of stories or biographies of individuals who are interred there. And we would also like to provide that for the Harrison, so that if people who are there, they could get a sense of some of the, mm-hmm. the occupations, the life stories of these individuals who are buried there.
And that could certainly be part of a library, can be part of a museum, it can be part of the churches that hold the archives to have that information. So there are many, but that's wonderful that thinking of digital, because that is something when you tour the cemetery, you really won't have a chance to see the biographies as you would want to tell people to go to certain places to read about them.
If you're looking for volunteers to help, if you are looking for more financial support from the community, how can people contact you?
I would say Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, 20 Parish Drive in Chickamauga. There is a special account
in that church because they were holders of the archives, one of the oldest African-American churches. And that would be a place that they can donate with a notation, District Hill Cemetery. It's all organized where it is separate, but it's for that. That would be one place. And I'm sure with a Google, it may be the Hazelrigg Farm, I don't know. But I do know Friendship Missionary Baptist Church is one way to donate. And you can send money there, and it will go to the right account.
All right. Joyce, Alicia, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's an effort to support the work of diverse artists in the Chattanooga area. Five local artists, all of them African American, have received a grant from Arts Build, the nonprofit for the arts in Chattanooga and Hamilton County. Tomorrow evening, starting at 5:30, the artists will be celebrated at the first Arts Build After Work, a monthly community gathering. Miriam Manda is with Arts Build, and Charlie Newton is one of the local artists who received a grant. Miriam, Charlie, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here. Thank you for inviting us.
Yeah, we're really excited to be here.
Tell us more about the racial equity grants for individual artists.
As you know, Arts Build's mission is to build a stronger community through the arts. So we're excited to announce that our five local artists receiving awards for the racial equity grants for individual artists program. And this program is a renewed grant fund to support local artists of color that are reflective of our community. And this year's program was made available to artists who identify as Black or African American and who are living and working in Hamilton County. Grant funding was made available through our generous funders that include the Ben Wood Lyndhurst and Footprint Foundation.
And Charlie, you yes. are one of those artists.
Yes, luckily. I'm very, glad to be part of this great project.
And you are a painter, you are a visual artist.
Yes.
Tell us more about what your grant will help provide.
Well, my grant will help fund a major art show of my collection next year, 2022, at Stoveworks Museum. So what the funds does is it helps me to survive as an artist, helps me to buy art supplies, it helps me to document the work, and also it gives me peace of mind so that we can put together a great show for next year.
And that show is about the Black Bible.
It's called The Black Bible.
And it is an exploration of Black spirituality.
Definitely. That's definitely what it is. And I happen to be a Black preacher. And so I'm putting all of my years of experience as a minister, and my work also involves spirituality. It deals with Black spirituality, I would say, Black Southern spirituality.
And for somebody such as myself, a relatively recent arrival to Chattanooga, how would you begin to explain that thread of Black spirituality compared to other parts of the country?
Well, what I'm doing is I'm really trying to show my point of view as a Black Southern spiritual artist. And so the show may end up being sort of controversial because of that. So it's my take on the church and the connections between my history and Africa and spiritual concerns as far as faith and the Bible and how that's been transmitted down through the ages. So it's really my take on it. And I'm trying to uncover some things that may not have been recorded in history.
These grants for artists such as yourself, they are meant to begin to fill in such a gap when it comes to when we say equity in the arts.
Yeah, exactly. As Arts Build has been taking a look at our funding, one of the things that's kind of apparent, and this is an issue across the country and the nation, is that a lot of minority artists specifically are underfunded. And so we are trying to create more equitable funding throughout all of our grant programs. And so the Racial Equity Grant for Individual Artists is a way to financially support local artists through these individual grants that are $10,000 to all of the artists. So we have five artists that were selected. So as you mentioned, Charlie Newton is one of them. Kofi Mowoku is another. The Artist Seven, who's a muralist, Carl Cadwell, and Anthony Wiley. So these are all local artists who are going to be using these grant funds to support their work through either individual projects or through professional development.
And at Arts Build, there will be an event to recognize all of this.
We are launching a new monthly community arts gathering event series called Arts Build After Work. So our inaugural event will be celebrating these grant recipients, but Arts Build After Work is going to be a safe and creative space and an opportunity for us to come together as a community to enjoy live music and celebrate and share the arts in our community.
And that will be?
So the Arts Build After Work will be this Thursday, July 22nd at 5:30. And we're located at the Arts Building, which is at 301 East 11th Street, Suite 300.
For more information, artsbuild.com, RSVP on Facebook. And one more thing about Arts Build After Work.
This series is part of the Live Music is Back summer series, highlighting several concerts across Chattanooga this summer through September. And it's a partnership between the Chattanooga Tourism Company and the Tennessee Department of Tourist Development. Musicians, performing arts organizations, and event production companies will help animate the city streets and stages all summer long. So for more information for that, you can go to visitchattanooga.com under their events, concerts, and live music section.
And we should also mention, Charlie, you have been keeping Splash Youth Arts going this summer, even with the pandemic. Tell us a little more about
that. During the pandemic, we had to switch to online classes, and so we've had classes on Facebook and YouTube and all of that. But we actually started back our in-person classes two Saturdays ago, so I'm very excited about that. So we're doing what I call a slow or a soft reopening. And Splash is basically a free art school for kids who might not be able to afford to pay for art classes.
And if people want more information about Splash, where can they go online?
They can go online to splashyouthartsworkshop.org.
All right, Miriam, Charlie, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Ray.
Tomorrow evening, singer Kimmy J. Soul and friends will present Arias of Classic Soul at the Hunter Museum here in Chattanooga. The performance, starting at 6 p.m., is another celebration of local creatives bringing their interpretations to the themes in Power, Passion, and Pose, the current special exhibition at the Hunter. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment.
This is Scenic Roots talking writing. Our guest again this week is poet and essayist Sherry Poff. Sherry teaches writing and creative writing to sophomores and seniors in high school. A founding member of the Chattanooga Writers Guild, she's widely published herself. One of her recent essays, titled Exploration, won the Chattanooga Writers Guild's writing contest in June. It's a story about a trip to Cadillac Mountain in Maine. Before she read the story, we started talking about the weather.
It is just stunning. It's absolutely stunning. And it's, you know, I tried to describe it a little bit in that piece in The Pulse, but it's difficult to describe, you know, like so many things. If you see it for yourself, it's so much more meaningful.
Two things occurred to me to ask you about, really. We live surrounded by mountains here in Chattanooga.
Yes.
You grew up in the mountains.
I did.
But that was in West Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And so from Chattanooga to West Virginia to Maine is going further and further north. And the natural world looks quite different, I would imagine.
It does.
It feels different, too.
Well, and here's the thing I love to do. In the spring or in the fall, you can really see this. To begin here in Chattanooga and start driving north, let's say it's April. When I start driving north, it's as if I'm going back in time, you know, because I'll leave here. The trees have green leaves. The azaleas are blooming. And as I go farther north, you know, there are just the beginnings of leaves. And, you know, now the daffodils are blooming. And it's, and of course, in the fall, you know, you can see that change as well. So that's something I love. And I tell you, well, the state song of West Virginia is called the West Virginia Hills. Yet it's called the Mountain State. But one can also really see the difference in the elevation of the hills here. And as you get on into, you know, like we're just in the Appalachian foothills here, as you get on into the Appalachians, you can really see a big difference. Long about out in East Tennessee, going into Virginia, I usually go up 81. You can really see, you know, begin to see they get kind of wilder, you know, taller and deeper valleys and things like that. And
these are old mountains here, aren't they?
I think so. Yeah.
So what was it? What was your sense in Maine? Did it feel particularly wild there?
You know, it was very similar. My daughter, who lived in Maine for 7 years, told me that the people and the landscape reminded her very much of West Virginia. And, of course, the being that near the ocean makes a big difference. And it is colder.
It is, isn't it? Elizabeth has this abiding affection for Maine because she doesn't like the heat of the summer, you know. And so the other day, maybe it was Sunday, it was really cool. It must have been late, upper 60s maybe, you know, for Chattanooga in the summertime.
Sure. Yeah.
It's like, really? Wow, this is great. She said, well, this is what Maine's like all the time.
Yeah.
You know. I thought, oh my God, if it's like London then.
Yeah.
So if it's like that in the summer, in the winter, it's going to be cold. You know, and that's a brutal place to live, you know.
Yes. My child, who lived there for 7 years, said that she had stayed as long as she could, and she needed sunshine. But she went back, you know, she went back this year for a visit, because in the summer, and what they say, at least what she tells me, I don't know, it's what all Mainers say, but that they say there are three seasons in Maine: winter, mud, and July. So the one time we were there in June, and it might have been the same time I was writing about, and there were people walking on the street in overcoats. You know, and I had taken long sleeves and a jacket because I thought I'm going to Maine, but I had to put on layers to be comfortable.
So, in June?
In June, yes. So, yeah, winter, mud, and July. I guess I was in the mud there in mud season, maybe.
A few years ago, that was quite a few years ago, actually, now think about it. So we decided we're going to go to Dublin. And this is in June. And we get there. Well, predictably, of course, it's raining and hard, too. It's almost like you battle the elements in a place like that. London's not quite like that. It rains a lot in London, but it tends to be a kind of almost like a misty rain a lot of the time. So it's annoying, but because if you want to have a picnic or something, but it's not any big deal. But it was lashing down in Dublin when we got there. And then the next day, it was on the weekend, so the next day we were out walking and the wind was blowing and the rain was blowing straight at us. And I'll never forget this kid in one of the stores. He said, "Oh, so what do you think of all summer?" You know, they just hated it. You know, the weather was so inhospitable.
Oh.
And I could relate, because growing up in London, I felt the same way.
Sure.
You know, we'd watch Flipper or something like that on the television, like, oh man, look at that. What must it be like to live in a place like that? You know?
Sunny and warm.
Yeah. And so... I guess if you want the, Cliff Notes version, that's how I ended up here. would you get it? Do you have a copy? I can give you my copy if you'd like to. I'd like for you to read it, though.
Okay, I do not have a copy of it. I do not. I could use yours.
Yeah.
All of it?
It's not that long, is it?
No, I suppose not.
If you don't want to read all of it, that's fine too. Maybe we shouldn't read all of it, huh?
You know what?
Read enough to get somebody interested.
I can go right through it if you want me to.
It's your call on the show. Whichever way you'd like to do it.
I'll go ahead and read it. Northeast. Several years ago, I traveled with my husband and two of our grown children to Cadillac Mountain in Maine, a treat I had anticipated for some years since learning that it was reportedly the first spot in the United States touched by the sun each day. We missed sunrise on Cadillac, but one afternoon we drove up the road that snakes around the mountain to the summit. Each of us enjoyed a walk atop massive cliffs and along a paved trail overlooking the ocean, taking in the beauty of the place in our own silence, and finally gathering for pictures. It was spectacular, even on a cloudy day. Wind-blown pines and shrubs on the mountain's side seemed to blend with the green further down and spill right out into the Atlantic, creating islands of emerald and jade in the blue-gray water. But we were not alone on the mountaintop that day in June. Many other visitors had arrived to enjoy the view and experience the magic of the place. Online guides to Acadia National Park, of which the mountain is a part, boast of the accommodations for tourists who visit the site, noting the large parking lots, restrooms, and even a gift shop. When one has the mountain and the sea, I have to ask, who needs to shop? In 1960, author Wallace Stegner composed his wilderness letter to members of the Wildland Research Center of Berkeley, California. Stegner's main point in his now-famous letter, commenting on the upcoming report of the Outdoor Recreation Resources Review Commission, even the title oppresses, was that the idea of wilderness is necessary to American freedom, to the notion that we have a place to escape the noise and pollution of our everyday lives. But the author was not interested in opening up more spaces for fishing or camping or even hiking. What America needs, he claimed, what people need, is a place free from the taint of human smells and waste, a place that we know is there as a buffer against crowds and noise, against domination by humankind, even if we never go there. In 2014, on a road trip with my 85-year-old mother-in-law, Dorothy, I whiled away hours on the big tour bus reading Bill Bryson's A Walk in the Woods. Bryson's tale about his experience on the Appalachian Trail with his buddy Stephen Katz is funny, informative, and impossible to put down. I read it all the way from Princeton, West Virginia to Niagara Falls, pausing occasionally for meals and chats with my traveling companions. After a quick drive across eastern Canada with stops in Toronto and Quebec City, the bus headed south back toward the heart of Appalachia. One whole morning we rolled through New Hampshire and Vermont right alongside the mountains. Traveling down the highway with soaring slopes out the left window, I mused while Dorothy dozed. Here, a variety of tree species creates a seeming carpet of green, but looks are deceiving, and I recalled Bryson's stories of rocky trails and steep vistas. I can't help but wonder, I said to one of our group as we stepped off the bus to get some much-needed exercise, who might be walking on that mountain ridge right now? I was standing on an asphalt parking lot next to a noisy bus emitting smelly fumes, but up on the mountain, under the shelter of oaks, hickory, and maybe even some chestnuts, the path was surrounded by birdsong and fresh air. The knowledge of its presence was like a secret promise, like the tiny shell one carries home from the beach in the sandy bottom of a dress pocket. For much of the past year, we have been trapped by an enemy we cannot see. Crowds are discouraged, even forbidden. In a time when loving my neighbor has meant staying away from my neighbor, I learned to lean more heavily on the distant view, the view of the trees across the road, the blue sky overhead where crows and the occasional hawk move about unhampered by boundaries. I look to the hills in my East Tennessee home and my mind travels northeast, past fields and farmland, along river valleys and up I-77 through the tunnels, Big Walker Mountain and East River. Here the air is light and fresh. Though it is midsummer, wild honeysuckle fills the evenings with fragrance and nights are cool enough for a sweater. Along the ridges, fireflies dot the evening with tiny lights and barred owls engage in long conversations filled with laughter. I search the now dark sky for familiar stars not visible near cities, but sharp and bright here in the hills. And far to the north, way up on Cadillac Mountain, the edge of America is slowly turning to face the sun for another day. Wallace Stegner noted that while early Americans were working their way west across the continent, the wilderness was working on them, shaping the American conscience and showing us that there is value in what we leave alone, what we choose to leave wild. The wilderness is a promise, assurance that when we have the time and the leisure and the freedom, there is a place we can go, even if only in our minds, a place where green and blue melt together in the distance, and we won't need a gift shop.
I love that. Thank you. One of the first songs, American songs, that I really liked listening to was Route 66. And in some ways, around the same time, well, probably a little later, I started reading Jack Kerouac.
Mm-hmm.
And those two cemented in my mind what America is to me. It's movement. Of you know, the notion that I often traveling through this country, try to imagine what it must have looked like to the people who first mm-hmm. came here.
Oh yes.
You know.
Yeah.
And that notion that, well, what would it be like to not know what's on the other side of that hill?
Right.
It's not on a map.
Right.
Nobody's been there to come back and tell us about it or say that this is where they live, you know.
That would be remarkable. I think about that, too. When I drive along the interstate, I think, you know, here where this road is was once woods or possibly a meadow or something. Right. And there was a time, of course, when the Appalachian Mountains was the western boundary. You know, I had the opportunity this summer to go to St. Louis. I'd always wanted to go to St. Louis since I was a little girl, see the arch. You know, and that was the Mississippi River. So it was the Appalachian Mountains, then it was the Mississippi River. And you know, I can see how to people who traveled on foot or on horseback or in a wagon, it just seemed unending. Like you could just keep going forever.
And that has a profound effect on your psyche, I think.
It must, yes.
Because I grew up on an island.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I know how it feels to know that if you drive more than 60 miles, there's no more road.
Wow, mm-hmm. Yeah. That's interesting.
Well, the other thing that it occurred to me when you were talking was that idea of the lockdown, and we have to content ourselves with what we can see out of the windows.
Mm-hmm.
We were talking before about getting older. I think one of the things about getting older, which is quite, I don't know what the adjective is actually, to be honest, but it feels as if we've come full circle. Children have a fairly tightly prescribed area they know, don't mm-hmm. they?
Yes.
Where we can travel, you can ride your bike or whatever it is.
Yes.
Or walk. It has to be close enough. You can either ride your bike there or walk there. If it's any further
right.
than that, then it's probably outside of your boundaries. And as we get older, the world starts shrinking again and we're back to that again, you know. And I haven't reached that point yet, so I'm not quite sure what that feels like.
I haven't either. But, one of my daughters keeps telling me I have to go to Chicago, and she said to me maybe a couple of years ago, "You never went to Chicago." I said, "My life isn't over. Give me time." So
she wants to make sure you catch all those things on your bucket list.
I guess so.
I've been to Chicago a couple of times. It's cold. It was in March.
Mm-hmm.
One time we went there, and it was still snowing. And
mm-hmm. Well, I've been near Chicago. My daughter and I, the same one, went to Wheaton because she was looking at Wheaton College as a possibility. And so Wheaton is just on the outskirts of Chicago. Yes, it was March, and the snow was deep, and the wind was biting, and
the wind was wicked.
There was just a tiny bit of sunshine, and people were sitting outside, and you know, Sarah and I were just rushing to get inside. I would probably really love visiting there in a warm season. That's what I'll aim for.
Sherry Poff is a member of the Chattanooga Writers Guild. This is from a virtual meeting with her colleagues in the creative fiction and writing group. Before reading a poem, she talked about what she felt made for good writing.
Poetry particularly can require a second reading, and that's okay. But I should have a sense of a message when I finish reading it. You know, I want words that seem to be the right words, a precise use of language. I guess that's, you know, that's a short way of saying what I think is good writing. Because I think a well-written poem deals with truth of some kind. Mm-hmm. You know, you can have a narrative poem, you know, Song of Hiawatha or something that just tells a story. But most of the time, I think poetry deals with some kind of truth.
This is the poem by Sherry that was published by the East Lake Language Association in the summer of 2020 during the pandemic.
It's called March 1st. Out of school for bad weather, I dice a potato, feel the wet velvet on my fingers. Scrub and slice two carrots with sunburst centers. Frozen peas, white corn, pungent celery leaves, and last September's cherry tomatoes, chopped and frozen for the day I would need to believe in summer. Pot simmering, I step into near darkness. The day's gloom gives way to pink marble behind wet black branches and the faintest hint of a crescent moon. Daffodils and pears are in bloom. Bright spears of forsythia pierce the gray blanket of evening. As hungry, I turn home. Steaming fragrance welcomes me. Against the side of the pot, my spoon's silver edge easily cuts through a chunk of potato. I ladle the promise into my bowl.
Last week, Sherry quoted Wendell Barry's advice to a writer. This poem is another example in which she takes his advice, writing a poem that celebrates everyday life by catching a few moments. It's a theme she returned to when the other members asked her about the poem.
When did you write that? And what was the situation? What inspired it?
Well, it was not this past March, but the previous March, I really was out of school for bad weather. It was a gloomy day. I started a pot of soup and I was peeling the potatoes and chopping the carrots and doing all these things. I was just really kind of immersed in all the smells and the feelings and the, it was quiet. I was working by myself. And so all these images just kind of piled up. And then I went for a walk, just as the poem describes. And I thought, Wendell Berry said or wrote that sometimes when you're trying to write a poem, what you need to do is just describe what it is you see. And don't worry about trying to make it sound a certain way. Just describe it the best you can. And then you can tinker with it and put in line breaks and things like that. But that's what I did here. I thought, I'm just going to describe my evening, making this pot of soup and taking a walk, and then that was the result.
You can find many of Sherry's poems online. Just Google her. The easiest way, Chattanooga writer, and then her name, Sherry, Sherry Poff, Poff. This is Talking Writing on Scenic Roots on listener-supported public radio in Chattanooga.
I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.